CityPublicRadio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBall. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin is set to attend the upcoming Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in Qingdao, China, later this week. It will be Putin's first state visit to China since he began his new term in office and will also mark his first meeting with China's president, Xi Jinping, this year. In advance of the visit, Putin sat down earlier this week with Shen Haixiang, president of the China Media Group, for an exclusive interview, and we bring you now excerpts of that interview via the program The World Today from China's global television network's English language service.
President Putin, thank you for this interview with the China Media Group.
Firstly, I'd like to thank you for your interest in Russia. I'm also grateful to you for coming to meet me. I'd like to avail myself of this opportunity to offer my best wishes to the Chinese people.
On May the 7th, you were sworn in as President of Russia. For the inauguration, the China Media Group's various media platforms provided a live telecast and coverage. I myself watched the live coverage.
We are aware of our many friends in China. Their attention has demonstrated great interest in the inauguration and in Russia. I send my best regards to the Chinese people, and I wish each and every Chinese family happiness and health.
At noon on May the 7th, inside the Kremlin, the inauguration of the President of the Russian Federation took place. As the clock began striking, Vladimir Putin passed through the St. George Hall and the St. Alexander Hall before reaching the St. Andrew Hall, where he was met by Valery Zorkin, chairman of the Constitutional Court of the Russian Federation. Having been handed the symbols of office, Putin officially became the President of the Russian Federation for a fourth six-year term after previously coming into office in 2000, 2004 and 2012.
и свободы человека и гражданина.
For your fourth presidential inauguration, did you feel any difference compared with your previous inaugurations?
As to my new term as president of the Russian Federation, I think you've read about my remarks. Our top priorities will be the country's sustainable development, continued economic growth, an innovation-driven economy, upgrading infrastructure, healthcare, education, and of course, guaranteeing national security. This is something we're working for as a team. While adhering to international law and respecting our partners' interests, we will meanwhile safeguard our own interests and pay close attention to our standing on the world stage. In this regard, I would like to point out that we've always stressed cooperation with our traditionally reliable partners, allies and friends, which without doubt includes the People's Republic of China.
On March the 1st, 2018, President Putin, during his third term in office, delivered the State of the Nation address to the Federation Council and State Duma. The speech came later than usual, as according to political convention, the Russian president delivers the State of the Nation address at the end of each year. The two-hour-long speech, delivered just before the presidential election, was viewed by observers as Putin's fourth-term presidential campaign manifesto. He took the opportunity to call on Russians to strive to action, assume their responsibilities, and create together the Russia of their dreams.
I've noticed that since the State of the Nation address this year, you have talked about your dream of Russia on several occasions. Right now, the Chinese people are working hard to realize the Chinese dream envisioned by President Xi Jinping. What does your dream of Russia share with the Chinese dream?
Russia and China are neighbors. Through centuries of mutual dialogues and interactions, we've formed a profound historical bond and strong foundation. Indeed, the relationship is based on our mutual interests. As you know, in 2001, we've signed the Treaty of Friendship, which has supplied the essential foundation for the towering edifice of our current bilateral ties. Each year, this great building has been renewing itself and has seen new floors added and has its structure continuously strengthened. This has not been a matter of luck. Now let me quote President Xi Jinping's speech at the 19th CPC National Congress. What's the most important part? How did the Chinese president put it? It is to improve our people's lives. There are many ways and manners to achieve this, but the goal is the same. In Russia, except to improve the living standards of our citizens, there's no other goal. For this purpose, we've been studying how to build Russia's relations with China, how to accomplish our objectives and guarantee external security, how to encourage innovation, the digital economy and genetic technologies, how to build a modern, harmonious society and nation, and how to improve our economic governance and foster the new economy. Therefore, we have a great deal in common. I'm confident that our efforts will bring fresh achievements.
Summit diplomacy plays a vital strategic role in the development of relations between nations. In recent years, guided and promoted by Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Putin, China-Russia relations have reached an historic high. Following President Xi's state visit to Russia in March 2013, the two have met frequently. Their encounters have included state visits and bilateral meetings on the sidelines of major international summits. Over the past 5 years, President Xi and Putin have met on more than 20 occasions, five times in 2017 alone.
Награжден Си Цзиньпин, председатель Китайской Народной Республики.
On July the 4th, 2017, in Moscow, President Putin presented President Xi with Russia's highest state honor, the Order of St. Andrew.
In the past year, you have held the most meetings with China's national leaders and talked with President Xi Jinping on five separate occasions. People in China were especially impressed when you presented President Xi with Russia's highest order of St. Andrew. Can you tell us about your impression of President Xi?
You know, this is awkward to talk about. It relates to my private views and our personal relationship. Perhaps President Xi is the only national leader who has celebrated my birthday with me. I've never had such a relationship or arrangement with any other foreign colleague, but I did it with President Xi. Actually, the birthday celebration was rather simple. I've talked about it in public, and there's nothing secret. To tell the truth, we just had some vodka together and carved some sausage. I don't know if he will be upset with me for saying this. It was after a full day's work, and then President Xi came for my birthday. It's a bit of a digression, but you talk about President Xi, I'd like to start with it. He is approachable and sincere, but he's also a very dependable man to work with. To be sure, when we talk about a certain matter, I would approach it from my standpoint, and I understand he would approach it from his standpoint. Both would try to fulfill his respective duties. This is the first point. Secondly, to be honest, like leaders of other countries, he would do his best to maximize what he could achieve for the benefits of his people. He is a remarkable thinker who likes to analyze problems. It's very interesting to talk with him about issues regarding world affairs and economy. So, as far as I'm concerned, he's an appropriate partner and a good friend I can count on.
From June the 6th to the 10th, President Xi and President Putin will meet again, this time in Qingdao, China, where the 18th Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit will be held. This is the second time after Beijing in 2012 that the summit will have taken place in China, where the SCO was inaugurated. It's also the first SCO summit to be held since its membership was expanded.
In just a few days, you will head to Qingdao to attend the SCO summit and also pay a state visit to China. With more members, the SCO will need to be more effective. How can we achieve that?
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization used to be a low-profile organization when it was first established. It was primarily aimed at solving border issues between China, Russia, and former Soviet Union members. As I mentioned, our objective was quite small. But as we worked together on these small issues, we found similarities between us. We realized that together we could achieve something bigger, grander, other than solving border issues. The SCO has developed. Obviously, it has become a more global organization after India and Pakistan officially joined the group. In fact, the SCO member states account for 1/4 of the world's GDP, 43% of the international population, and 23% of global territory. These are very substantial and huge resources. Plus, we have seen Asia's economic growth accelerated, especially with China and India making big strides forward. Russia will also provide momentum for new growth to keep up the pace. In addition, there's our military potential. Of course, we're not raising rivalries against anyone. This is simply a necessary condition to ensure multilateral cooperation between the member states and other countries, no matter which continent these countries are on. Uniting these strong powers will undoubtedly become an important factor for our development, and one that could influence the world in a positive way, I believe.
Qingdao is a beautiful coastal city. It is well known for its seafood and beer. Would you care to try?
Sure, I would love to. I like seafood and beer, but I will try not to drink too much. I would like to have a taste, and I will do so.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was established in Shanghai 17 years ago on June the 14th, 2001. It's grown from its original six member states to an organization comprising eight member and four observer states, along with six dialogue partners. The SCO has won worldwide recognition by championing international relations based on mutual respect, fairness and justice, and win-win cooperation. This year also marks the fifth anniversary of the One Belt, One Road initiative proposed by the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Most of the SCO member states, observer states and dialogue partners lie along the ancient Silk Road and share the Silk Road heritage. Therefore, how the SCO can coordinate its activities effectively with the One Belt, One Road initiative will be a focus of the Qingdao Summit.
It has been 5 years since President Xi Jinping proposed the Belt and Road Initiative, which is designed to create a common community with a shared future for mankind. So what is your understanding on this practice?
We have always been a firm supporter to this initiative. President Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative incorporates concepts of the economy and humanity. The essence of the initiative is to develop both the economy and infrastructure. We think the Belt and Road Initiative is a beneficial and promising initiative. It matches our efforts to establish an alliance in the Eurasian economy. On May the 17th, China and the Eurasian Economic Union signed deals on economic and trade cooperation in Kazakhstan's capital, Astana. This agreement not only touches on issues such as lowering tariffs, but also involves other important matters, including policies on trade and technology, as well as planned quarantine measures. In fact, it was a significant step for further eliminating restrictions on economic development and cooperation. And we believe that President Xi's initiative has a wider global vision in boosting cooperation and development for all countries and continents. For Russia's initiative is focusing on integration in Eurasian economic development. I think the two initiatives will produce better results if working together, and we recognize the importance in doing so. For instance, in infrastructure, we know that our Chinese partners are very interested in the Northern Sea Route, and we welcome that. But that is only one of the directions in our cooperation. China and Russia have great plans in industrial cooperation as well as constructing railway infrastructure. The cooperation prospects are tremendous and promising. They will also lay a sound foundation for boosting future cooperation. China is Russia's biggest trading partner. Last year, the total trade volume between the two countries reached $87 billion. And the growth of last year's first 4 months was equivalent to the total growth of the previous year. That was very good momentum, and we need to maintain it and boost it.
On the day he took the oath of office, May the 7th, Vladimir Putin signed a presidential order establishing the national development goals and strategic tasks in the social, economic, educational, and scientific fields that Russia aimed to achieve by 2024. The presidential order stated that the Russian government will halve the number of people living in poverty, increase real incomes and pensions, and maintain economic growth at a rate higher than inflation. The average life expectancy of Russians would rise from 73 years in 2016 to over 80 by 2019. The Russian media summarized these indicators set out by Putin in a single phrase: for Russians to live longer and better. It was also significant that the presidential order stressed that Russia's expenditure on developing the digital economy would increase threefold by 2024.
I am very impressed by your latest policy agenda on the Russian people's livelihood and the country's digital economy development. In what fields can Russia and China conduct in-depth cooperation?
It is indeed a major direction for development. As we know, President Xi and the Chinese government made tremendous efforts in economic modernization, as well as boosting development in prospective sectors such as the digital economy. There's no doubt that it is closely related to future technological developments, including automation and artificial intelligence. In today's world, innovations, especially especially those with great potential, all happen in science and technology. In the fields of biology, genetics, and others, scientists and technological personnel will be the world's leading forces. While we join efforts with our Chinese friends in the new areas, cooperation in the traditional fields will also continue. We have conducted intensive studies in these areas, and we have plans and intentions to cooperate with China. We know that China has garnered remarkable results in the Internet of Things and e-commerce. However, it is not enough for Russia and China to work together to pursue short-term development. We should also work together to develop such sectors as digital technology, manufacturing, infrastructure, energy, and alternative energy. Then we can not only utilize the results from scientific researches, but also convert the results into new driving forces to produce more results. If we can achieve this, then we will unquestionably become world leaders in these areas, and we're set to work towards that end.
While domestic affairs concern people's sense of worth and happiness, foreign affairs concern their sense of security. In recent years, President Putin has been striving to ensure the security of the Russian people, from Chechnya to South Ossetia, from Crimea to Syria. His tough stance on security issues is obvious to all. As a result, the Russian people now feel safer. However, the security risks have not been completely eradicated. Economic sanctions, military containment, and regional power plays have become serious areas of contention between Russia and the major Western countries. Since the Ukrainian crisis in 2014, the United States and Europe have imposed economic sanctions on Russia. In particular, since President Trump took office last year, the White House has unleashed a series of sanctions storms. All in all, the external environment for Russia has become more and more problematic.
Dialogue and cooperation as equals is a wish for many, but you have been facing a top challenge. That is the economic sanctions on Russia by Western countries. Where do you think relations between Russia and Western countries will be headed next?
I'm hoping for a positive relationship, where we're not surprised nor scared by current limitations and sanctions, and we will never give up the path of independence and sovereignty. My point of view is Russia should either be a sovereign state or not exist at all. Of course, the Russian people will always choose the first option. I think the Chinese people would make the same choice. We have no other choice. But we are aware that through those limitations and sanctions, our companions have been trying to achieve one goal, that is to restrain our development. I have no doubt that this attempt, in the legal sense, is called impossibility defense, is an affirmative defense. None of these will have an effect. Those who will suffer loss will be the ones who play tricks. I believe common sense will finally win. And all those illegal limitations and policies that will hurt the development of the world economy will gradually dispel. We will normalize our relations with all cooperative partners, including the U.S. and countries that impose sanctions on us under the thumb of the U.S. By the way, as I said, those countries who followed America's actions have suffered loss themselves from the U.S. decision. I'm not taking pleasure in others' misfortunes, nor am I sneering. But it has been proven that these means are not at all potent. It will hurt everyone sooner or later, including those who carry them out. Above all, I hope our relations with Western countries can be normalized in some way.
Even though the relations between Russia and the West are at almost their lowest point in history, Russia has played a key role in resolving many international disputes. The country became involved in the Syrian conflict in 2015. On the day of this interview, the Russian foreign minister was visiting the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, where he held a brief meeting with the country's leader, Kim Jong-un. During their talks, Sergei Lavrov said that Russia hopes to see a peaceful, stable, and prosperous Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia.
Though the situation is still not so clear, positive changes have been seen in some conflict areas, such as the Korean Peninsula and Syria. What kind of role does Russia hope to play in solving international disputes? And what kind of cooperation can China and Russia have?
On the DPRK issue, as our diplomats had said, our position on both sides is very close or completely consistent. It is the latter, to be exactly. We have put forward a roadmap to resolve the Korean Peninsula issue. The People's Republic of China has done a lot of work recently to ease regional tensions. We're pleased to see this and will be fully supported. As you know, the Russian foreign minister is visiting Pyongyang and holding talks with DPRK leaders. We can also see that the DPRK leadership have made unprecedented efforts to ease tensions, which honestly surprised me. On one hand, they announced the suspension of missile tests and nuclear tests. Furthermore, they have dismantled one of the biggest nuclear sites. These are no doubt important steps to our final goal of denuclearization. When DPRK leaders said they need an absolute security guarantee to reach the goal of denuclearization, I can understand. Is there any way else? Otherwise, we cannot imagine the consequences, especially after the tragedies in Libya and Iraq. All this has been visible before the DPRK's eyes. So it is self-evident that they want the guarantee. As for the content of the guarantee and the time limit to carry it out, it is still hard to say. But what we can say and what we should say is that we need to take the road of easing the situation to achieve denuclearization. It is regretful that our Western companions, and regrettably South Korea, have not stopped drills and military actions, which go against easing the pressure. It is a wise and mature decision by U.S. President Donald Trump to have direct contacts with DPRK leader Kim Jong-un. Anyway, I hope the planned summit can be held, and we're looking forward to a positive outcome of the summit. I just mentioned the roadmap by China and Russia to resolve the DPRK issue, and the next step is to deepen relations among those countries who helped ease the Korean Peninsula situation. The next step is that all countries who are interested, especially those in this region, can multilaterally participate in the formulation of a security guarantee. Of course, as I always suggested, and what we are currently doing is the negotiation of trilateral economic projects. Coming first are infrastructure projects. We're talking about railway construction projects, such as the Inter-Korean Railway, which, by the way, can also be joined by China, and also the building of natural gas pipelines, as well as other kinds of energy projects. There will be a lot of opportunities for trilateral or quadrilateral cooperation. What we need now is to push forward in this direction. We're all looking forward to the outcome of the dialogue between U.S. President Donald Trump and DPRK leader Kim Jong-un. And we will try our best to contribute to the success of the meeting.
Командир президентского полка, полковник Филякин.
Здравствуйте, товарищи!
As president of Russia, Vladimir Putin enjoys widespread popularity in China. Prior to this exclusive interview, China Radio International, part of the China Media Group, co-hosted an event with Rossiya Segodnya under the title Who's a Fan of Putin? Within a week, as many as 10 million Chinese internet users had responded. CCTV New Media launched a page to collect questions to be put to President Putin. Within a few days, the page had attracted 24 million views and received over 40,000 messages.
I'd like to pick some of them to ask you.
Go ahead.
Russia is the host of this year's FIFA World Cup, so what do you expect from Team Russia?
I think as the host, our first priority is to do our best to put on a great show, to make it a fantastic festival for soccer fans from around the world. That is going to be our top goal. As for Team Russia, I'm sorry, but I have to admit that it hasn't been doing so well in recent years. But still, all the fans in Russia are looking forward to seeing the team try their best and fight till the end. We hope the team can deliver modern, fun, and also fantastic games for the audiences.
Which team do you think will be the champion this time?
It's hard to tell. Several countries have a fair shot. For example, I think Argentina and Brazil from the Latin America group both have a shot.
Would you kick off the opening game?
I will be watching the first game. As the president of the host country, I will attend both the opening and closing ceremonies. And I will definitely check my schedule and see if I can catch some other games.
Who's your favorite soccer player?
Among all Russian players, I like Lev Yashin, who is the best. He is from former Soviet Union. Internationally, Pele has been my favorite. I also like Maradona a lot.
The public know that you love sports. What kind of sports do you still do, and how much time do you spend?
I work out 2 to 2.5 hours every day, mostly in the gym using fitness equipment or swimming. I would also do some judo when there is a trainer around. I play hockey, but only occasionally. I can't say I completely know how to play because I'm still trying to learn.
We often see you on TV flying jets and steering submarines. In China, people say you could be a star on the internet if you won the present. What would you be doing if not working in politics?
I used to work in the foreign intelligence agencies of the Soviet Union, and now I have this career as a president. Actually, I graduated from law school in St. Petersburg University, so I could be a legal advisor or lawyer. However, I worked for national security departments my whole life. I went on to work at the city hall of St. Petersburg after the intelligence job in the Soviet Union.
I
truly loved those jobs, but in the meantime, I believe I'm also qualified to be a lawyer.
You brought a box of Russian ice cream to China when you were in Hangzhou G20 2 years ago. It has become very popular in China. So what are you planning to bring this year?
I will definitely bring something, that's for sure. I brought some ice cream as a present to President Xi because he said he loved Russian ice cream. We exchanged gifts, but it wouldn't be a surprise if I talk about it on television, what I'm going to give President Xi as a present this time. So for now, I'd like to keep it a secret, but I could tell you later in private.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Faced with frustration and dismay from America's allies, even members of the GOP, Donald Trump is sticking to his campaign promise to recast Washington's trade relations with the world. The reaction has been loud and swift. Are we on the verge of a global trade war? Cross-talking a possible trade war, I'm joined by my guest, Steve Malzberg in New York. He is a conservative political commentator. Also in New York, we have Sarah Hsu. She's an associate professor of economics at the State University of New York. And in Exeter, we have Alistair McLeod. He is head of research for Gold Money. All right, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Sarah first in New York on Skype here. It's not hard to find the term trade war in the mainstream media, corporate media here. Are those overblown expectations? Because I've been looking at a lot of CEOs reporting on Bloomberg, and they're keeping their forecasts more or less the same, their investment projections moving forward. Of course, they're mindful of this, but I sometimes wonder if it's being a bit overblown. You know, Donald Trump is a larger-than-life figure. Go ahead, Sarah, in New York.
Well, right now, we're not entirely sure what President Trump is going to do. But that being said, he has stated that he's going to implement $50 billion in tariffs on goods imported from China. And this is going to result in retaliatory impacts from China. China has promised to impose tit-for-tat tariffs on U.S. goods. And this is going to strongly affect both the U.S. and China in terms of consumers and producers. And in fact, we're already seeing some of the blowback from that. China has stopped purchasing soybeans from the U.S. Due to the threat of a potential trade war. They canceled about 63,000 metric tons of soybeans by mid-April. And they're purchasing a lot more from Russia, a lot more from Brazil. And American farmers in Michigan and Iowa have already been hit really hard.
Okay, well, Steve here, I mean, obviously, Sarah's already brought it up, the blowback here. I mean, I guess if you're going to get into a trade war and you consciously get into a trade war, you have to figure you got more punch than the other guy or other guys, because the Europeans are furious right now. But they've been very much coddled over the last 70 years, and I'd like to talk about that. I think there needs to be a redress of issues there. Sarah's issue with China, I think, is separate. But, you know, Donald Trump made a campaign promise, and he's keeping it for better or worse, Steve.
Absolutely. And you know, China and the European Union, Canada, Mexico, they're separate issues, really. In China, I think the ultimate goal is not only to bring down the $350 billion trade deficit that we have with China, but also to get them to stop stealing our intellectual property and treat us more fairly in that respect. So I think that's part of a grand scheme. Plus, there's geopolitical considerations beyond trade and economics that China plays into. As far as Canada and Mexico, especially Canada there and the European Union, they're really ticked off that Trump is using the pretext of national security to implement these tariffs on aluminum and steel in particular. And that's ticking them off no end. Trudeau has been very outspoken about that. But I think when push comes to shove, they need us more than we need them. They know that Trump is a grand master at bargaining and negotiations, and this is all part of it, I believe.
Okay, Steve, we'll go back to that, but I think on the whole you're right, but I think that the U.S. and the Trump administration is underestimating the options others have in the world here. Let me go to Exeter. Alistair, react to some of the things we have said here, because there's a very real possibility there could be a real trade war, but I don't think we're there yet. It depends on how everybody reacts, okay, and not just to words. Donald Trump is good with words. Let's see about actions. Let's go to Alistair. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite buy this story that Trump is really having a go at China and all the rest of it. I think it is part of a negotiating process, and I think we have to bear in mind that there are two things going on in the background. Firstly, we've got midterm elections coming up later this year.
Good point.
And secondly, there seems to be an ongoing battle within the White House between the established intelligence services, it seems to me, and Donald Trump and maybe the military on his side. And so there is a sort of turf war going on, which actually is all about geopolitics. And I think we've got to look at all this sort of talk about trade wars and all the rest of it in that context. As we saw over North Korea, I mean, Trump can get very, very aggressive, threatening to, you know, nuke Rocket Man and all the rest of it. And then the next thing we know, they're talking and they're going to meet in Singapore. And then it's off and then it's on again. I think this story is going to run and run and run. Now, I'm not actually wildly pessimistic about what Trump is doing. I think that there are talks going on which we're not privy to between America, China, and also America and Russia on trade. Now, when it comes to the EU, I think that's a slightly different thing because the EU is the one protectionist bloc.
Yeah.
I think America is protectionist as well, but I certainly don't see Russia and China being protectionist. And this idea that by putting up trade barriers or tariffs, that you can reduce your trade deficit. That, to me, is a complete misnomer, because a trade deficit is comprised of the excess production of money within the economy. And this is why you get the twin deficits effect. And this is why if you get one country tending to save more than the other country, you will again tend to get a trade deficit. So it's those are where the imbalances start from, and I think that's the thing that really needs to be addressed. And I just hope that behind all this rhetoric, that either Donald Trump or his advisors actually understand this point and know when to compromise and withdraw, if you like.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm going to go to Sarah right now. It's just in what Steve said and Alistair just said here. There are so many dimensions to all of this. I'm worried about the law of unintended consequences, because China isn't the European Union. They're very, very different. Sarah, you wanted, you wanted to jump in even after Steve spoke. Go ahead.
I think that there's a strong misunderstanding about what a trade deficit is. And the trade deficit is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not a win or lose type of situation. When you have a trade deficit, that means that one country is purchasing more goods from the other country than they are from the first country. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Both sides have yet to gain in trade. And the issue with China is that they purchase less from the U.S. because the GDP per capita there on average is about $10,000, whereas in the U.S. it's $52,000. So as Americans, we purchase, we have a lot more purchasing power, and we purchase a lot more from China than they do from us. And we win. We get cheap goods. There's no losses there.
Okay, let me go back to Steve in New York. How much of this is this political? Because we already heard mentioned the midterms being mentioned here. Is this something that Donald Trump needs to serve up to his base? Because as we've pointed out here, his base in the process could be damaged. I mean, it's a delicate balance, isn't it? Go ahead, Steve.
It's a very delicate balance. I mean, you look at the states where the farmers are and the hurt that they're feeling in many respects and could feel down the road. But in that case, Donald Trump has promised to use federal funding that's available to bail out, if you will, the farmers. He promised that they will not suffer. I don't think he needs this politically for the midterms right now. I think he's riding on the tax cuts. He's looking to make the individual cuts permanent. He's looking to pass that legislation prior to the midterms. He's also has the summit coming up on June 12th or 11th our time, if you will, you know, if you want to get technical, with North Korea. And he's talking about a summit with Putin. So I think he has enough accomplishments and he's doing enough things to satisfy the base and motivate the base heading into the midterms. But this is something I've known Donald Trump to interview him and to, you know, and to have a relationship in that respect with him since the early 80s. And then it was sports. But when it matured from sports, this is something that has always been on his mind. The way we're treated unfairly, whether it's in NATO, whether it's through trade, whether it's with bad deals. And he ran on fixing these things. He is fixing these things and he's going to fix these things. It's one big negotiation. And we have yet to see where it will end up. We don't know where it will end up. You know, one day there's no tariffs, there's no trade war. Next day he's putting tariffs on. It's all part of a grand scheme. He keeps them guessing. May not be a good thing,
okay,
but that's how he operates.
All right, Steve, let me go back to Sarah. But, you know, it cuts both ways, Steve, okay? Markets, investors don't like unpredictable, unstable situations. And I think this is what the environment we're in. And on top of it, the kind of rhetoric that's been used against China, I don't think is a very good negotiating strategy with the Chinese. Go ahead,
Sarah.
Yeah,
I have to say that the Chinese, this is not how they negotiate. They see this type of maneuver as a slap in the face. And the way China negotiates is by making conciliatory measures going back and forth. And this is something that is going to potentially stonewall our relationship with China and have a really negative impact. It also hasn't helped the stock market. Every time there's an announcement about potential trade wars, the stock market goes way down. And also companies, both in China, multinationals in China.
What's way down? How many times have we seen the stock market go way down?
Then it went back up, okay? This is proving my point, Steve, okay? We have these really good extremes going on here. The stock market is doing very, very well. Everybody knows that. But when we made the announcement, I think it dropped 250 points. Again, this unpredictability. That's the issue I'm trying to highlight here.
What's 250 points, with all due respect, in today's market of 25,000? 250 points is nothing.
So are you saying that investors don't care about a potential worrisome reaction?
Okay, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to continue our shouting and discussing when we get back. After our short break, we'll continue our discussion on trade war. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Alistair. I want to read you a few words, a quote here from Jeffrey Sachs, a very well-known economist, particularly in Eastern Europe and Russia, not for the best reasons, I'd like to point out. He has described Donald Trump as isolating America, and he declares him a psychopath's trade war. How do you react to Jeffrey Sachs calling the president of the United States a psychopath?
I think psychopath is a bit over the top. I mean, he is. I know he didn't get elected on the basis that he was like the other politicians, but he is a politician. And, you know, he behaves rather like one, just maybe a little bit differently. He hasn't spent a lot of time studying the book on the art of diplomacy. But, you know, he's got his own way of doing things. And I think that's fine. We'll get used to it. It's not a huge, great problem. I think the other thing is that what we see in the headlines, of course, you've got a press which, you know, having been accused of fake news and all the rest of it, I mean, they're not all that kind to the man. They never were. They're never on the same page as Donald Trump to begin with. So an awful lot of what we hear, I think we've got to take with a bit of a pinch of salt. The feeling I get is that there is a lot of communication actually going on between Donald Trump and President Xi and also Vladimir Putin. I don't know this for certain, but this is the way things work. You have back channels. And so the idea that this public slanging match, if you like, you know, on the one hand, it's going to be 10% tariffs on 25% tariffs on something else, and then China responding. I think this is really for the public, if you like. And as I said earlier, you know, we are in coming up to midterm elections. That, I think, is very, very important. So you've got all this sort of stuff going on. But I think at the end of the day, things get sorted out in the background. And I'm quite optimistic that this won't degenerate into something really serious. I think there are other things that do worry me, however, and that's really over the isolationist stance of America. It seems to me that the rest of the world is actually growing quite well without America. America will grow well on her own because she's putting in a massive budget stimulus. And that budget stimulus, I think, which will coincide with China's purchases of raw materials, with the way the European Union is beginning to take off, I think that's going to lead to big inflation problems down the road. Now, that might, if you like, put an extra spin into this, if you like, trade tariff type thing. Because this is bound to increase protectionism, I think, in Europe and also possibly in America.
Okay, Sarah, well, then what is the role of the World Trade Organization? I mean, and again, this is Western-driven. The rules were conceived by the West. China did join, and a lot of people said took advantage of it. That's a different topic and subject and program itself here. But it seems to me when we have so many of these large economic blocs or powers squabbling among themselves, then the whole point of having the World Trade Organization is really quite meaningless. And what about NAFTA? And what about if and when Brexit happens, what kind of relationship is the UK going to have with the United States vis-a-vis the European Union? I mean, what I'm saying is that it gets very, very complicated. There's so many different angles and different dots that connect here. And then you have the largest economy in the world. And yes, it is China. In the middle of it all. Go ahead, Sarah.
I think that the World Trade Organization was created based on the presumption that the world was moving towards a system of free trade. And the U.S. was leading that ideological effort. And now the U.S. is moving away from it. And so the WTO, it has become less relevant in a way, particularly for American politics, potentially for the UK and elsewhere. And I don't know that it's necessarily going to be something that people are able to ignore entirely. Certainly the tariffs that our president is attempting to impose on China, as well as other countries, would be questioned and possibly rejected by the World Trade Organization. I don't think that it's necessarily going to become a thing of the past, the World Trade Organization, that is. But I think that somehow there might have to be some reorganization of it. Either that or the U.S. will have to go through another ideological change, again, towards free trade. But that's not the direction that we're moving in currently.
You know, Steve, you know, the United States, you know, there's a long lineage of protectionist strategies that presidents have deployed and to grow and industrialize the American economy. I mean, it's been a big plus being very selective here. But, you know, again, there's the historical thing. And I mentioned in the beginning of the program is that after the Second World War, Germany and Japan, later South Korea, were really given really sweetheart deals by the United States to grow their economies for geopolitical reasons, of course, during the Cold War. No one denies that. But the Cold War has been over for a long time, and it's time for the Europeans to, you know, in every sense, pay their own way. Okay, a NATO trade and all that. I mean, I understand the logic of Donald Trump in doing this here. The United States is very benevolent to this part of the world because of geopolitical reasons, not because we're all kumbaya and like each other. No, it was for good, solid geopolitical reasons. But those reasons are evolving and changing, and everybody has to pay their way. We all know what's happened to the middle class, the working middle class in the United States. If it's not suffering, it's gone. Okay, that's why Trump was elected. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I don't know that it's gone. I think it was suffering, and I think that's one of the reasons Donald Trump was elected. But you're absolutely right, and the Americans are fed up with the scenario that you just portrayed there. They realize what we had and why we had it, but there's no reason to really have it anymore. And what I'm talking about, basically in Donald Trump's terms, is that America keeps getting screwed and gets the short end of the stick, whether it is funding in NATO, whether it is in trade deals, whether it is in funding the United Nations, no matter what it is, or the Paris Accords that we dropped out of. It's always the United States that bears the brunt of the burden of the cost when there are other countries that can well afford it and don't pony up what is their fair share. And this is all part of the thinking, all part of the mindset of Donald Trump, and it extends to these trade deals and trade in general. And that's why you're seeing what you're seeing. And his base loves it. And so do the American people. They love it. They don't want confrontation, but they don't want to get stepped on anymore. Those days are over.
Okay, Alistair, let me go to Alistair. I agree with a lot of what Steve there had to say, but it wasn't, you know, this is not just state to state. These are corporations, and what we saw over the last 30, 35 years is Western companies moving their production outside of the country, making huge profits, not being repatriated. I mean, the reason why we have these policies is not just, you know, the president has fast track ability. Who wrote all those bills? I have a pretty good idea who did, and it wasn't politicians. I can't remember the last time any politician actually wrote legislation. It was always a lobbyist. Go ahead, Alistair and Exeter.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about lobbyists, and I think lobbying is just appalling, and I'm looking forward to Brexit, so there's no more lobbying in Brussels as far as we're concerned. But I just want to sort of go back a little bit, and you know, I think the sort of concept that Germany and Japan got sweetheart deals after the war, they got financing, yes, but I don't think we should rubbish the effort that those two countries,
no,
or
fine,
the people in those two countries,
agreed,
put
agreed
into their recovery.
I agree.
I mean, it was
that's fair.
It was very, you know, and not only that, but the big difference, The big difference between Germany and Japan and America was Germany and Japan, when they borrowed to invest in production, in more efficient production, in production which people actually wanted to buy. In the case of America, they expanded credit, really, not for production, but for excess spending. Rather like Italy today, if you like, a worse not quite as bad example as Italy today. So, you know, in a sense, I think, I think to sort of, blame the Germans and the Japanese for being successful in the post-war years, I think actually misses the whole point.
No, the point about trade. I'm not dismissing hardworking Germans and hardworking Japanese and really hardworking South Koreans. I'm not dismissing that. Okay, please.
So what is
We're rapidly running out of time. Sarah, you wanted to jump in. That's the point of the program. Go ahead.
So I don't know that the U.S. is necessarily getting the short end of the stick. I mean, as you mentioned, American multinationals have gone overseas and they've produced in China and other countries before that at a really low cost and then made a huge amount of profit in exporting those goods back to the U.S. and other nations. So I don't know that our free trade policies have necessarily been, against our own interests.
Okay.
I would disagree with that.
Okay, let me go to Steve here.
You're absolutely right. Where are Apple phones made?
hang on, because all of you disagree, and that's fantastic. Let me go to Alistair real quick, and then I'll go to Steve. Go ahead, Alistair.
Okay. Now, I think the point actually that Sarah was making is right. I mean, where are Apple phones made? In America? No. Designed there, maybe, but basically they're made in Eastern Asia. So, trade is global. And if you start throwing spanners in the works, then basically consumers will pay. And the rate of inflation in America will only increase if Donald Trump introduces trade tariffs. It's really as simple as that.
Okay, Steve, I'll give you the last word of the program. Go ahead. How is this making America great? How is this making America great? 40 seconds.
Well, Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader of the House, is backing Donald Trump on his tactics, threatening the tariffs. He points to Canada, for instance, and says, look how they treat our dairy products. Look at our wines, which can't go on their supermarket shelves. So it becomes a matter of pride. It becomes a matter of being treated fairly. The optics of being treated fairly as well are very important here. Don't overlook that.
Okay, well, I'm going to end on the note here and probably be controversial for all of you. You know, I don't tend to see the United States as a victim in the world very often, okay? So let's keep that in mind, and we'll see where this is going to go. We've seen the past trade wars are bad for everyone. That's it. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Exeter, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.